Concession number 17620, James Watts, Reel 2.
Mr. Watts, Reel 2. We were talking about the bombing raids that you were experiencing in Sunderland, Mr. Watts. Can you go on with the stories? How severe did they get in your time that you were there?
They were very, very severe in Sunderland, of course, because it was the biggest shipbuilding town in the world, next to Hamburg. And, of course, it was the ships that they were after most of the time, but there were lots of other things that were in the process. I mean, they weren't just building such things as frigates. My wife helped to build frigates. She was a welder. And it was a communications area as well, you see. A lot of things came through Sunderland. But I was present when the bombing was probably at its worst in the first 2 years of the war. The Victoria Hall was destroyed when a landmine hit it, and I ran down the high street in Sunderland with my bucket and no water and my stirrup pump to put a fire out, which set one of the biggest departmental stores on fire. Another episode about that was a fire engine came flying from the north end of the bridge and stopped on the corner and asked where the fire was. And I said, "Where are you lot from?" And he says, "From Gateshead." Our fire brigade was at South Shields, putting the fire out of South Shields. The incident when the train was hit, you've got to imagine that the train is below the level, it was more or less underground Sunderland Station, still is. And it whipped part of the engine bogey wheels at the front straight out of the station and put them in Mr. Joseph, the sports outfitter, he was a sports outfitter, etc. And they put them in his front window. He used to use that as how we won the war sort of thing, like, you know.
Did you see your first casualties and deaths at this time? Did you get that close to it?
No, I didn't. That's quite a point. That's the first time I've ever thought of that. No, I never saw any person being carried away. Saw some firemen who'd been hurt. They seemed all right. They were just moving away from the fire, because it's quite an awesome sight when you see a huge block on fire and there's only one hose trying to calm it down, you know.
How did the people of Sunderland take this in your experience?
Oh, philosophically, most of them. I can give you an instance of my mother. She lived on the outskirts of the town, and they dropped fire one night. They dropped incendiary bombs. One has fallen through the coal house door in the backyard into the coals, but they put the fire out. Later, when I went home, my mum says, "These coals, they're burning like mad." When I looked at the fireplace, there was a silver glow. There was bits of the incendiary still catching fire. And it burnt the grate out. So, that's a new grate I want. But I think they were pretty philosophical and reporting back to work the next day after a right night, you know. My mother used to enjoy our raids. I think she, especially when they used to drop flares, she says the place is like daylight out there. And there was one particular night an airplane got shot down in Suffolk Street in Sunderland. And she was standing at the top of the stairs, and this airplane was coming down and getting closer and closer in its last ditch. She just slid down the wall and along in a dead faint. Yeah. And she used to wait for the... She was in a dead faint. But other times when the airplanes were coming over, she would be saying, "Come on, Grangetown, come on, Grange." That was a battery of anti-aircraft guns at Grangetown. And first of all, Marsden would have a, they would have a go as well, you see. But come on, Grangetown, and she'll wait for the guns to actually go and get them. That's probably where I got my fighting experiences from, you know, because I mean, my father was very, he died in 1937, but he was a very placid man, didn't like war, not like me.
The war started, obviously, we were talking about the early days of the war, before you were old enough to go in.
Yes, really. Yes.
How did it come around that you did join the army? How did that come about?
I think it was when I saw the aeroplane shut down. I think I mentioned that earlier, didn't I? The aeroplane had got shut down, and my brother, of course, was in the, he was in a Scottish regiment, and he came home on leave, and I thought, well, I think I'll have a go at the army. And I went to, first of all, to join, I wanted to join the tank corps, because being small, I was just the right size. But a chap in the recruiting office, a big bully of a man with a big shade on, oh, he says, I've got something special for you. And that, of course, was the Young Soldiers Battalion of the County Regiment.
So, in effect, you volunteered? You weren't conscripted?
Yes. No, I volunteered. I volunteered, I think it was a day or two after my 18th birthday in May 1941.
How did your mother and your family think of that? How did they take it?
I had two younger brothers. I was 18, the younger brother was 13, and the younger brother still was 8. So they were outsiders. But both became members in the cadet corps later on.
Did your mother worry about the fact that at such a young age you were going?
Years later, I used to think about when I think back on my mother. I used to think she had two lads in the army, and they're both in the infantry, and how she must have thought about her young ones away, you know, because I remember when my daughter went to university, my wife was, she was a bit put out when she went away, you know. So of course you miss them, and I think it was different then than what it is now. I think your family bonds were tighter. I had one or two cousins also, they were in the forces, you know, a bit older than me, and they'd been in, they were in the Royal Coast Signals and the Air Force, etc., you know. They, but
can I, before we go on with your army experiences, what do you recall was the general attitude when Dunkirk happened? How did the people around you take that defeat after all?
I think a lot of people, and I might be looking back with hindsight, but I don't think people knew what war was about. I don't think they realised that an army of men could land on the south coast like they had done about 800 years previously. But they didn't understand war, really, what it was all about, I don't think. They knew that it brought shortages and sacrifices, but perhaps now and again when they... Some member of the town who was in the forces was killed, they'd have something in the paper, and then it would make people realise that something was happening somewhere in the world. But for most of the time, you could easily escape from it all, you know. I mean, if you come up to where I live now, there was eventually about 30,000 soldiers here. So you couldn't really escape it, could you? But you could escape the bombing, etc. I mean, stationed as I was at Barney Castle at the School of Infantry, we were never bombed up here. We were shelled. We were shelled when we were giving demonstrations on the moors, but we were never bombed.
But the public, this was the disaster year of British history in the war, and the public seemed to just accept the fact that, you know, they weren't defeated by Dunkirk.
No, I don't think they were. I think there was an eagerness to get to grips with the Germans. Whether or not that was the right attitude, I don't know, but on reflection, it probably wasn't. But I think most people were philosophical, took things as it came, and they would be disappointed at what the devastation they would see when they came into work. You know, I remember when I worked in the departmental store, the young girls would come in and say what the house across the road had been bombed and that was it, but the people were being looked after. So, you know, there was a resolve there that we weren't going to lose, I think. There was times in my life when, going through the war, I thought we might.
When you joined the, or were put into the 70th Battalion, how was that done? Did you get a letter through the post telling you that you would report somewhere?
Yes, I had to go to the 4th ITC.
Had you had a medical when you went to join? Did they give you a medical?
I had a medical before I went in the army at Old Elvet. I had about 7 doctors and they examined me and I was in and out in half an hour. A1.
Just down the line of doctors?
That's right, yes.
And they would be experts in various parts
of your body? I think so, yes. The examination I had wasn't as thorough as what some of the other lads that I joined up with, you know. But, and then eventually we were told to report to the 4th ITC in Brandsmith Castle, which was the...
Had you to take an oath when you joined?
Yes, I got the King's Shilling. I didn't keep that long, though, because money was always scarce and a shilling was a shilling.
But you were, in effect, a volunteer. Did you volunteer for an indefinite period, or...?
Yes, I volunteered for 7 and 5. But during the war, during my war service, I was asked if I wanted to change it to duration of engagements, which I did. Not because I wanted to get out, but I wanted to get home. When you've got responsibilities at home, they lie heavily on you. On the other hand, the colonel of the regiment I actually fought with, but one particular colonel used to pick married men for dangerous missions because he knew they looked after themselves better than the others. They were a bit more cautious.
We'll come to that later on when we get down to your actions and so forth. So you were to report to the 70th Battalion. What date did you join?
No, I reported to the 4th ITC.
What date was this?
And that was on the 17th of December 1941. And a fortnight later, New Year's Eve, the colonel of the ITC, Colonel Hastert, he committed suicide.
Did anyone ever discover why he did this? Was it any knowledge on that fact?
No, I mean, on a more humorous point of view, he probably saw the likes of me walking about and saying, poor dear me, I've got a job on here, you know. But, I mean, we were only there 3 or 4 days, you know, and we were being taught to say, one stop, two stop, three, and we had to do it quick.
This was what, for...?
Marty, I was there about 3 weeks at the 4th ITC, the Infantry Training Centre.
How did they receive you on that very first day when you arrived at the gates?
They took us, we were escorted by a quartermaster, straight away into the castle, where we were given our kit, which we had to carry from the castle into the barracks, with the wooden huts.
What kit were you given?
Our army uniform, etc.
What did that comprise of then?
Battle dress, the usual things, you know, the usual clothes and boots, of course. You had to have your boots.
How did they measure you for this? Or were you measured for
that? That's always the thing, that we always used to say that some of the battle dresses we got, they must have been made for people who were deformed. But I've always been good with the needle and thread. And when I became a corporal, I used to do my uniform, you know, put a tuck in here and a tuck in there. And we used to alter the trousers so there's a bit more leg room at the bottom around the ankles. We used to put flares in. And one of the lads says, how did you do that, Jim? I says, oh, right, get yours off and I'll do this. So after a while, after a few tucking here and a stitching there and altering buttons, etc., my section was the smartest. In fact, I remember one time when we were having a kit inspection in the barrack room. I'd worked in the ladies' outfitters, remember, not far from Marks and Spencer's, etc. We put our clothes hanging up on the wall, and I folded the overcoat so the lapels were back and there was a scarf in and it was tucked up so that... And when the sergeant came out, he said, "Good grief, who's done this?" I can still picture the sergeant when he saw how I'd put all the suit, the different clothes out, how they were hanging in that. They had to be folded in a certain manner, you know, like your blankets in a blanket.
Yeah, we'll come to that. I want to ask you about that. Yeah. Can we just stick those very early days at the moment?
Yeah.
In effect, they'd look at you and say, "That was your size," and handed you the piece of uniform.
Yes.
As you went along the line.
And we used to, eventually we would perhaps would swap over with somebody else, eh? "I think this one might fit you better than it fits me." So we sorted ourselves out. But strangely enough, I'm 4469415. Charlie Russell was 416. And Willis was 414. And I've always remembered their two names, you know. But that, and there's others I can remember, you know. Because we all had a DLI number.
So you collected your uniform, as you said, and then you were marched to your barracks. Yes. What were your barracks?
Well, they were wooden huts.
This was the main campus.
That's right. This was the wooden huts, and we went to Ladysmith Hut.
Can you describe your accommodation to me?
Yes, it was a big wooden hut which would shelter about 30 lads. Our beds, of course, were three planks on two small trestles, so that you were just off the ground. It's all right laughing, Harry, but the point is, if you didn't have plenty underneath you, and the middle plank was more pliant than the two on the outside, it would nip your bum. I used to often lie on the floor, sleep on the floor. But you learn the tips, you know. Remember, you always sleep better if you've got more under you than what you have over you. And that came in good stead, that. That taught me a lot.
The three planks.
Yes.
What, did you have palliasses or biscuits on top of that?
After about a week, when we moved to the battalion and joined the battalion at A Club, we were given a palliass and we had to put straw in.
That was when you came to A Club?
That's right.
But you were lying on boards.
No, that's right, we were just lying on the boards with a blanket, one on and two over the top. I think some of us got a fourth blanket, I'm not quite sure, because we weren't very warm.
Pillows? Did you get pillows?
Why, no.
So what did you use?
No, your boots. Your boots and your battle dress blouse made of pillow. Or stuff your kit bag and use your kit bag. But throughout most of my army life, I never had a pillow. I slept straight flat, you know.
Where did you keep the rest of your uniform and equipment that they'd given you?
We just folded up.
No lockers,
not at that time, no. That was only for about 3 weeks.
That's right.
And I think I had a few days off for Christmas. I'd only been in the army about 4 days when I got Christmas leave, you know.
So if we can stick to the accommodation, there was some 30 men in this room. How was it heated?
A potbelly stove in the middle of the room.
And was there a fire in the stove? Were you allowed a fire?
Oh, yes, you get your fire. And, of course, there would be a ring round the stove. Seats would be, you know, bring a form up or something like that. And if you're on the outside, I learned later, if you just threw about two or three blank cartridges in, you could easily get up to the middle when they went off.
Keeping the barrack block clean, how did you do that? And I know you were just there, as you say, a few days, but
obviously
you'd have to do this.
We cleaned it. We scrubbed it. We had big scrubbing brushes. They were about that long, about 50, well, it'd be a foot long at least, these brushes, and we had to really scrub, you know, hard. Later on, of course, in other barracks, we didn't have it was polish.
But this was scrubbing?
We had to scrub the floor, yes, and scrub your boards, your bed boards.
And was that done daily?
No, but they had to be clean. and have not if they weren't. You know, they moved you. I think one of the indoctrinations of joining the light infantry is that you've got to wear your forage cap in the middle of your head. You can't put it on your ear or around the back of your head. If you've got any hair sticking out the side, the hairdresser takes all the hair that's hanging out.
You would have to have an army haircut today.
Yeah, short button sides, or else. And we learned, those of us who took a pride in our appearance and liked our hair, you know, a bit vainer perhaps than the ones who were looked like convicts, we wouldn't have our hair balded. A lot of us did later on, mind. You know, in our army service, I had mine cut off, you know, avoid the lice.
But the Durham Light Infantry
rule
was that the hat had to be in the middle of the head. Yeah.
Yeah, and any hair sticking out was cut off.
Did they, in those very early days, give you a potted history, for example, of the regiment and what it did?
I still have my books. Now, strangely enough, I've got a little one. It was written by Lieutenant Edward Short. He was the first officer at the ITC, or in fact the Army, to give me an order, which was, right, you lot, let's see you get over that area shelter and back. And guess who was first? I was over like a shot and back again. Now, he became Lord Glenmara.
Politician,
yeah, in the Labour government. A nice chap, but that's all we saw of him, get over the area shelter and back.
What were the abolutions situation as regard the barrack block?
They weren't bad. We were civilized. I mean, they had, but there wasn't enough. I think we weren't catered for. There weren't enough toilet seats. You know, you talk about putting bums on seats. Well, there wasn't when we needed them. That was a thing throughout the war in regard to the infantry, but as regard to what was to follow, the conditions at Branchburg were quite good.
Were they flush toilets?
Oh, yes. And we had to keep them clean, or else.
Washing facilities, what were they?
They were much the same. We had wash basins and that, but perhaps in one or two blocks throughout the whole of the ITC. You know, I forget how many men were there, because besides the Durhams, I think the Duke of Wellingtons were there. And it's funny how you get up just before 6 o'clock, or reveille, whatever time it is, you know, but round about 6 o'clock. If you get up before the bugle blows, you can be in and out before the rush. And I think you learn these things, you see, so you're not caught on the hop. But I can still picture a sergeant that was having a wash it once in a basin. And when he's finished, he swirled it round and made it clean so that the lad who was following, which was me, of course. And these sort of things, you know, had to be learned, because if there was a piece of something on the floor, somebody had to pick it up. So you might as well pick it up and keep it clean, because you'd be told to pick it up. And how nope if you didn't.
We touched upon kit inspections there. Was there a special way of laying out your
kit? Oh, yes. It was very diagrammatic. I mean, and of course, the one with the best kit inspection, well, you got to let off quick. You know, well, you can go home now. You see, so there was always a little incentive for to look a bit smarter and do things a bit better. You had to fold your socks in a certain way. We found if we put a bit of cardboard in, it would look. You had to polish the studs on the bottom of your shoes, your boots. They had to be shown, and they had to have so many studs, no more, no less, and they had to be clean. Instep had to be polished. You know, all these little points which. It's disciplinary, you know, that's all it is. You've got to learn to do these things, and if you don't, you'll suffer for it later on, because discipline is important.
Do you recall the layout of your equipment?
Yes. Three blankets. If you had three brown blankets and a grey blanket, well, you put the three brown ones and wrap the grey one round. Or you could put the grey one in the middle of the two brown ones. You know, you make a different pattern and just put your hand at one side of the blankets and pressed the topping so it made it square. You know, all these little tips.
And then everything was laid out below that.
Oh, yes. Your mess tin, your housewife, your boots at the bottom. You had to leave your boots out, your best pair. I got mine stolen. Sergeant Major replaced them for free.
I was going to ask you later about this. But the layout, of, as you say, was to a plan.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Was an kit inspection every day?
No, usually on a Saturday morning.
And who did it?
The officer. The platoon officer would come round, or the company commander. Sometimes there were quite a lot of them would come round, you know, just for the sake of... I think it's discipline from the word go in the infantry. And you've got to learn. You've got to learn to be disciplined.
You say you lost your boots, and obviously other things were probably stolen. Was there a lot of stealing going on?
I can recall different moments in time when things like that happened. Eventually, I found it was useful as a platoon sergeant to have a pair of socks or something like that spare. And if anybody was short, well, he had a pair of socks, but not to steal it from somebody else. I can remember going out once for a shower, and I emptied my pockets and I put my money on my bed, and I think it was 1 tenpence. And I said, if anybody's short of cash in the field and must take that, then they must put heaven help them if I know who it is. So I went for a shower, and when I came back, it had gone, and I was disappointed. But one of the privates came up and said, "Corporal, when you went out, you left your money on your bed, so I put it in your locker." And that was more or less how it went from then on. It's a thing you've got to learn from one another. If you pinch somebody else's, he's going to be short and he's going to get wrong. So try and get an arrangement. So that's what I did. If you're short of some kid, come and see me. Because that's exactly what the Sergeant Major did with me. He obviously had a spare pair of boots, and he gave me his old pair, but it was a pair of boots, which incidentally were well waxed. And when I went on boot marches, I never had bad feet.
So was the Army quite sympathetic to people who either lost or had things
stolen? No, because I think some people took them home and sold them. I think I know who took the boots that I lost.
What was the drill then if you had something lost or stolen? And
The drill was that you didn't have stuff stolen, so you looked after your kit.
But if there was?
But if it did happen, I would immediately inform my senior officer. You know, it might be a lad's corporal. It all depends what part of the time it was in the Army. But as soon as I became an NCO, of course, I never had any trouble like that.
Did you have to pay for anything you lost?
Yes.
That was taken out of your pay?
Yes, barrack room damages and losses, kit losses, things like that you had to. I remember one lad, on one occasion, he was before his company commander for pay parade. That's right, it was pay parade. He went in and they gave his number, then private so-and-so, he says, "Sixpence, sir." And they put the sixpence across and... the chap said, "Sixpence?" He says, "What's this?" He says, "Barrack room damages, so-and-so, loss of pay for being absent without leave, so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so." And he threw the sixpence back, and it fell off the table onto the floor, and the company commander and the officer was making the payment. The company commander said to the other officer, "Put that man in a charge for defacing a coin of the realm." Oh, they, some of the things like that, which, you know, when you think about them now, they were laughable then, but they were twice as funny now.